tonight. The main event, I guess I could call it Elah's main event. That is the fight that is going to take place down in the Valley of Elah. A few weeks ago I was preaching and I was talking about when I was a kid, I used to like to go to the wrestling matches. Well, I remember one night, it was the main event. There was a bad guy named El Mongo. Anybody remember El Mongo? All right, four of you, okay. He had a ponytail. He was bald-headed like I am, except he had a ponytail on the back, and it would hang down a little bit, and it was braided. His signature move to win a match was the double karate chop. And he would double karate chop people. They would go down. It's over. On this particular night, they had announced it, you know, the couple of weeks before. And I mean, it was on billboards. The night of the fight, El Mongo was going to fight a guy named Paul DeMarco. Paul DeMarco was a good guy. He had a signature move. And what he would do is he would duck under, knock the guy's legs out from under him. He would wrap his leg around his leg. The guy would be on his stomach. He would fall backward, and the guy would give. And so we had the double karate chop, and then we had the leg whip when he would wrap it and fall. That leg whip really did work because we practiced it at home. And so the night of the fight, I mean, I'm jazzed. I mean, this is going to be the big night, and I'm thinking, this thing is going to go on for an hour. Now, they've already had some matches on the undercard. Well, then, I mean, you could feel the tension in the air. And you've got El Mongo, he comes out and everybody's boo, 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 boo. You know, I mean, we're booing this rascal, all right? Now, I wasn't cussing him like I did Stan Vachon. And then Paul DeMarco comes out and it's like, yeah. Well, El Mongo, he was bad to cheat, but Paul DeMarco knew it. And so that bell rang and they came out, and the first thing El Mongo did was he took his hands and he tried to karate chop him with the double karate chop. And DeMarco ducked, took his legs out from under him, and 3 seconds later, El Mongo was given, and it was over. Can you imagine that? 3 or 4 seconds, and the main event is done. We're going home. And I'm thinking, well, I'm glad he won, but I wished it would have went on a little longer. That's what we've got tonight. Now, when we look at our passage here, I want you to look with me, and I want us to kind of go back, and I want you to see how we got to this point, and I want you to see the posturing that we talked a little bit about last week, and how that there's talking. You know, there's bluster. The first thing we see from the writer of Samuel is we see that Goliath, he's bragging, and he is ridiculing. Look with me at verse 42. The Philistine came and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about in verse 42 and saw David, he disdained him. He belittled him. For he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves or with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come here, come to me, and I will give your flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Now, you've got David that's maybe 5'8", maybe. You've got a guy that's 9.5 feet tall. There's some commentators like Isby, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, that claims that he's over 11 feet tall. But at 9.5 feet, he's still 3 feet taller, basically, than David is. And so when he's looking down, am I a dog that you're going to come to me with sticks? I'm going to feed your carcass to the animals. Most people would have been cowering. Not David. Goliath's running his mouth. But let me show you how David responds verbally. He can put it back on him. Well, let's face it. The guy wrote half the Psalms. It wasn't like he was ignorant and unlearned. The guy was educated, and he had God on his side. So what does David say? Look with me at verse 45. Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts. You remember Wednesday night I talked about the Lord of the Sabaoth? That's it right there. The Lord of hosts is the Lord of the Sabaoth. The God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled. So you got this guy. I come to you in the name of the God of hosts. The Lord of hosts. The Lord of the armies of Israel. And he's looking up at him, 3 feet taller. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee. And Goliath's probably thinking, what are you going to do, step on a log? And I'm going to take your head from you. Now that's pretty big talk for a guy that's 3 feet shorter. And I'm going to give your carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with the sword and with the spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. So you've got Goliath, and he's talking. And you've got David, and he's putting it right back on him. Well, all of this now brings us to our text, verse 48. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose, in other words, he's looking down like this, and finally he's like, he's getting big, he's getting making himself big as far as his presence is concerned. And he begins to come forward to draw nigh to meet David. And notice the response. There's no backing up. There's nothing in David that says, ooh, he's bigger than I thought he was. No. It says, David hasted, and he ran toward the army. Now remember, one side of the Valley of Elah, you've got the Philistines. On the Bethlehem side of the Valley of Elah, you've got Israel. David has come down. The armies of the Philistines have separated. This huge champion has come down, and David is here. The Philistine begins to move, and David begins to run toward him and the armies of the Philistines. And what does David do? David put his hand in his bag, and he took thence a stone and slung it. Now that sounds like poor English to me. He slung the stone. Well, what stone did he sling? One of the five that he had picked up way back over in the earlier part of this chapter. Now, what did I tell you last week about the stone? Those stones were probably somewhere around the size of a tennis ball. They were known as the slingers way back over in Joshua. They had a group of people, and they would be like the archers. They would have the slingers. And so you've got five smooth stones. You say, why were they smooth? Probably because David knew that a smooth stone would sail more true than a jagged one. And so he slung it. That meant that he put this little stone that could have weighed maybe a couple of pounds. He put that in that sling and he began to twirl it. And he twirled faster, faster, faster. And when he let it go, I believe that God directed this stone. And that stone was true in its path. And what happened? It smote or struck the Philistine in his forehead. That's key here. In his forehead. That the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. Well, David prevailed with a sling and with a stone, smote the Philistine, and slew him. Now, I came across this week. I want you to look at some pictures that I have pulled off of the internet from antiquity. Go to the next slide. There you go. I want you to look at these various helmets. If you look at them, you'll find that they come in various shapes and they come in various sizes. But one thing that you will notice about many of these helmets, they all have the forehead protected. Just look at all eight of them. I mean, the only one that's even close to not being protected is probably number four and probably number seven. But even those are probably down to the eyebrows. And so when the text tells us that he was smote in the forehead, you know what I believe this means? I believe that this stone was traveling at such a rapid rate of speed, probably somewhere between 100 and 150 miles an hour, when it hit him in the forehead. And I personally believe that what took place was that stone caved that helmet in, and he was done. I mean, this was 3 seconds. This is Paul DeMarco time. All right? And so this huge main event is over. Well, when I look at this story of David and this whole chapter, there are three things that I want to give to you, and then we're going to finish the chapter as far as unveiling it and kind of unraveling some of the things that are left in the chapter. But the first thing that I want you to see is that the Lord prepares his servants. You don't find David, when he's 14, fighting this giant. Oh no. There's a preparation process that takes place. There are times when God has you do things at certain junctures in your life to prepare you for something that's going to come later. That's why you need to remember this, that there are no small jobs in God's service. It doesn't matter what you're asked to do. If you've got the ability to do it, you ought to try to do it. Because God may have something greater than you've ever dreamed. Well, when David was about 14, that's about the time that he was just watching some sheep. I mean, every once in a while, he would look over at them, and they'd be grazing pretty good. Well, what would he do? He'd pull out his harp and begin to play on his harp and practice a little bit. He didn't just learn to play the harp and become a master musician in a week. It was something that he probably worked on every day. As he was out watching the sheep, making sure that they were protected, making sure that they had water, making sure that they had a place to graze. During those times when they were eating, he would just be practicing. Well, when he got tired of playing his harp, he'd pick up a few rocks, put them in his sling, and he'd say, "I think I can hit that tree right over there." And he would sling that thing around, and it got to the point to where he was a marksman with a sling. And he got better, and he got better, and he got better, and he got better. And it doesn't matter what you do in life. If you practice it, you will probably get better. One of the things that used to really bug me, and it doesn't bother me as much anymore because I really don't get into sports the way that I used to, but it used to bother me to watch a guy in college and he couldn't shoot 50% from the foul line. That's free points. Free. F-R-E-E. Nobody's in your face. Nobody's standing over you with their hands up. All you've got to do, walk up to a line, bounce a ball, and shoot it, and you can't make one out of two. It was always my belief that any high school kid ought to be able to shoot 70%. And you get in college, if you've practiced enough to play college ball, you ought to be able to shoot in the 80s. And these jokers in the NBA, I don't know why they can't shoot 90. Some of those guys can't hit a jump shot from 8 feet. The only thing they can do is dunk. All it takes is practice. You walk up, you get your feet set, you bounce the ball, and you shoot the same way every time that you've practiced, and you can get better. David practiced day after day after day. And then the test began to come. The bear came, the lion came. And what does God do? God gives him success. And so the Lord prepares him. Well, how did he prepare him for the music? Do you not remember just a little short time ago, probably now 2 years chronologically? And what is he doing? He's in the palace playing his harp for the king. Why? Because he's a skilled musician. And why is he there? Because there's an evil spirit that God has put upon Saul because of his disobedience. And so, all of that practice time, it's now got him to Carnegie Hall. Why? Because he practiced and he practiced and he practiced. One of the things that has always amazed me about young men that say they want to go into the ministry. Oh, I believe God wants me to preach. Well, are you preparing? Well, no, I'm not going to prepare. If you're called to preach, you're called to prepare. You ought to study and you ought to try your best to get well grounded and well situated in the Word of God, because let's face it, when you're in a pulpit, you don't need to walk up there and act like Willy Lump Lump. You need to know what you're talking about. And so there's a preparation process. And the Lord prepares his servants with the circumstances that you find yourself in. Not only that, I believe that God planned his steps. He didn't just happen to show up in the valley of Elah. God put something in his daddy's heart, and Jesse said, David, come here, son. Your three oldest brothers are over fighting against the Philistines. They're over there with Saul, and I know they're hungry. He said, pack these animals and I want you to take them and I want you to deliver this bread and I want you to deliver this cheese. And when you get over there, find out how they're doing and bring a token back. Bring maybe a lock of their hair so I'll know they're okay. And so, what does God do? God planned his steps. God plans your steps. The steps of a good person are ordered by the Lord. If we're doing our best to walk with the Lord, I believe that God is going to have just the right things step in your life tomorrow morning. You say, well, what if it's trouble? It's still planned of God. God knows that you need to go through that. God knows that there are certain things that you've got to go through in order to be a better servant. I don't understand why sometimes bad things happen to good people, but I know this. I know that God is in the sunshine, but God is also in the rain. I got an email this morning from a lady that has She and her husband, they have a ministry in Israel. And I read that with great anticipation every month when I get this newsletter in my email box. And the reason is because I'm always interested in how things are going in the country, in the land, as some people call it. Well, they have a ministry not just to Jews, but they have a ministry to a group of people called the Bedouins. They're basically Arabs, and they live in tents, and they're out in the desert areas, and they have these little villages that they go to, and they witness to both Jews and to the Arabs, and they try to win them to Christ. And one of the things that she said was, please pray during this time of the year for the rains to come. Because you see, water is at a premium in Israel. And right now, she said, God has been so good to us. We have had storm after storm after storm. We've had the rains come. And she was praising God for the storms that were there. Because you see, when the summertime comes, there is no rain. And that Sea of Galilee, which is a freshwater body that provides probably 75% of all of their water for the whole nation, that needs to be filled. And they need to have those rains up in the north, up near where the Jordan River begins, up in a place called Caesarea Philippi. And all of those tributaries need to begin to run off those mountains around Mount Hermon, and they need to hit that river, and they need to just flush it and get it good and full. Why? Because the summer's coming, and they're going to need it. The storms are a good thing. And we don't understand it in our life when God sends storms, but storms can be a good thing. It can draw us closer to the Lord. I can't tell you the number of people. I can think of three men right now in the last year, and they have had horrible news step in, and to a man, every one of them has said to me, I can't tell you how good God has been to me through all of this. You say, that's just crazy. No, that is men that love God and know that God has got their days planned. And so David, his days were planned. But not only that, I believe that the Lord guided his actions. Look with me at verse 49 again. He took his hand, he put it in a bag, he took the stone out, and basically he killed him with one shot. And so somebody says, well, do you think that he died from that stone? I do. Now, there's some good people that don't think that that he did. They think maybe he was just knocked unconscious. Well, I know this. I know if you've got a child and that child gets a knock on the head, the doctor is concerned if the knot goes in or if the knot goes out. When my son was probably in about the fourth grade, the school called me one day and they said, Mr. Foskey, we need you to come over to the school. Dallas has got a knot on his head. He bumped his head with another boy. And I said, he'll be all right. I'm thinking, I don't want to leave the office and go over there for just a knot on his head. And they said, no, you really need to come over here. All right. So I got in my truck. I rode over to the school. I went in. He was sitting there. That boy looked like a unicorn. And I'm going to tell you something. He's 35 years old. I guarantee you, if you look real close at his head, you still see a knot. If that thing would have gone in, it would have put pressure even on that little brain of his. I mean, it would have been trouble as long as that knot was coming out if it would have been the other way. I think he was dead. But you see, everybody else might have thought, hey, he's just knocked out. He's just stunned. He's going to get his second wind, and when the big guy gets his second wind, there's trouble coming. No, there's not. He's dead. He's not getting up. But the Philistines, they don't know this yet. They're thinking, come on, Goliath, come on. And I mean, they're cheering him on. But what happens? David says, I'll just show them. Well, you got to realize now, everybody's sitting on their 5-gallon buckets, and they're like, yeah, we got something going on here. And so in verse 51, David ran, stood up on the Philistine. I mean, he got on his body. He took his sword, not David's sword, he didn't have one. The latter part of verse 50 said, there's no sword in David's hand. He takes Goliath's sword. And by the way, you'll find out later, as we get, I think, around chapter 21, you'll find out where this sword goes to. It goes to a place called Nob. All right? We're a ways from getting to chapter 21. And what did he do? He took the sword out of the sheath, and he cut off his head, and he holds it up. There's no doubt about it now. If the stone didn't kill him, the sword did. And what happens? Well, when the Philistines see David holding the head, they saw their champion was dead. They fled. If the big guy's gone down, we better get out of Dodge. We got to go. And they begin to run. And then all of a sudden, Israel, who has not really been doing anything, they've been paralyzed with fear. I mean, you've got Saul paralyzed with fear. Jonathan paralyzed with fear. You've got all of the champions, the 600 that were his bodyguards, paralyzed with fear. David's brothers paralyzed with fear. But all of a sudden, you've got a 16, 17-year-old boy. He's holding Goliath, the champion's head up, and they go, if David can do it, let's go get some. And they take off running after the Philistines. Well, let's look and see how the battle was going and how much of a rout it was. The men of Israel and of Judah arose. They shouted, they were excited, and they pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley. That's not the valley of Elah. That's a different valley. And to the gates of Ekron. Now, what's the gates of Ekron? Ekron was a Philistine city. There are 5 major Philistine cities. So one of the cities that was close by was Ekron, and the Philistines, they were trying to get there as fast as they possibly could. The wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Sha'ararim. That means the two gates. So they were able to get to two gates, but they were wounded, and that's as far as they could get. And no doubt they were killed there. And then even unto Gath, which was another Philistine city, unto Ekron, there's the city again that we mentioned earlier. And after they have done this, what do they do? The children of Israel return from chasing after the Philistines. They chased them all the way back to those cities that they lived in. Now they have experienced another defeat. For 27 years, they had been rebuilding their arsenal. Saul had defeated them 27 years earlier. Oh, but those people begin to have kids, and those kids begin to grow, and now you've got all these new young bucks, and they think they're you know, all this in a bucket of chicken. And the next thing you know, they suffer a defeat. Why? Because there's a teenage boy that says God's honor is at stake. And so the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. That doesn't mean that they went over and just tore the fabric up. It means they went inside of the tents and they began to loot what was in there. They took the food, they took the raiment, they took anything they thought was valuable, and they said, hey, they're not going to be needing it. We're taking it home with us. And so they spoiled their tents. But what did David do? Verse 54, he took the head of the Philistine. He's walking around with his head in his hand. You know what? He cut it off. I guess it's his. And so why was that a big deal? Well, in ancient times, what you had is you would have battles that would take place. And those battles that would take place would usually result in the death of either one of the captains or one of the kings that was leading the various armies. Well, instead of taking the whole body, sometimes they would just take a head. And they would take it and they would put it up on some type of spike or a pike. And they would just let it sit outside of a city, and it would be kind of like a trophy. Sometimes they would take the whole bodies and do that. As a matter of fact, King Saul and his boy Jonathan has that very same thing happen to them. If you go to Israel, you will find a place that the Romans basically developed. It's a place called Bet Shean. It's a beautiful place. They've got Roman architecture that's there, and I mean, you can see where they had bathhouses and how that they had granaries and they had theaters and all of these things that the Roman culture brought into the country of Israel. And just only a couple of miles away is a place called Mount Gilboa. And Mount Gilboa is where Saul and Jonathan were killed. And on Mount Gilboa, those enemies took their bodies and they hung them on the wall of their city. Why? Because they were trophies. And so what do you have? You've got a trophy. David is holding the head of Goliath. And what does he do? He brings it to Jerusalem. Now, what's significant about that? Israel did not control all of Jerusalem at this time. There's a group of people that live in Jerusalem called the Jebusites. They will be in Jerusalem until David becomes king, and David solidifies the whole country of Israel. And so he takes it to the Jewish part, the Israelite part of the city of Jerusalem. But what else happens? He put his armor. You remember the helmet? The one that now has a dent in it? He took the coat of mail that weighed 125 pounds. He took the shin guards. He took the staff like a weaver's beam. He took all of that stuff. And what does David do? When he gets back to Jerusalem, evidently he's got a tent by now. And he puts this stuff in his own dwelling place. And so we come to the end of the main event. Wasn't much of a fight. But Israel has now been encouraged because they have a champion, and he will later be the greatest king that they've ever had. All other kings are now measured by the standard of King David. If you were to ask people in Jerusalem, who's the greatest king that they've ever had, they would say, David. That's what they'd say. If you ask them who the greatest prophet was, they would probably say Moses. But if you ask king, it's King David. Well, verse 55 through 58 kind of changes gears on us a little bit. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, this is after the victory, he says unto Abner, remember, Abner is one of these mighty men. He was frozen in fear. Whose son is this youth? Now, to me, that's a weird question. It's a question that I struggle with. There are some reasons that I think he asked the question. But wouldn't you think that a guy that played the music for you, that caused you to get better, don't you think you'd remember that boy? I do. Well, David returned from the slaughter. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said unto him, "Whose son art thou, thou young man?" David answered, "I am thy son, or I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Let me just kind of posit some maybe answers to the question that I just asked. I mean, why would Saul not remember that boy? Well, have you ever had somebody that maybe developed a medical condition and they had a hard time remembering some things that happened in their life? Perhaps Saul just didn't remember him, but maybe because he's having some memory issues. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, I know that he had an evil spirit that visited him. And so perhaps there was some kind of medical thing that caused him to not remember it. Well, what about this? What about the fact that it's been 2 years? I've had young men come by here and they'd say, "Hey, Brother Tommy, how are you doing?" And I'm looking, I'm thinking, I know that kid, but I don't know if I know his name or not. He sure does look familiar. But yet I haven't seen him in a couple of years, and maybe now he's gotten a little bigger. Maybe now he's sporting a mustache or a beard. And he says, "I'm so-and-so." And I'm going, yeah, I can see that now. And so maybe David's appearance has changed in the last couple of years. Maybe he's not the same little 14-year-old boy that he was. Now he's 16, 17, you know, and maybe his appearance has changed a little bit. Well, perhaps he remembered David, but he didn't remember David's daddy's name. Before the service, we've got a couple of young men that are our guests tonight. And one of them is Matthew. And he told me his last name, and I looked at him and I said, "Is your daddy named Paul?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Okay. I know his daddy now." If he hadn't have told me that, I wouldn't have known that. And so perhaps he just didn't remember Jesse's name. And he didn't want to be embarrassed and be found out that he didn't remember it. And so what does he do? He gets Abner to kind of find out who that boy is. Who's he belong to? You say, well, why would he want to know Jesse's name? Look with me at the same chapter. I want you to go back to verse 25. David has come into camp. He's brought all the supplies that his daddy has sent. And he begins to ask these guys, what's going on? Verse 25, the men who are afraid, they tell him, "Have you seen this man that's come up? He's a big one. He's defying Israel. If it would be that there's a man that would fight him and beat him, the king will enrich him with great riches. He will give him his daughter, and he will make his father's house free in Israel." David was telling, "My daddy's Jesse the Bethlehemite. He's your servant." And Saul's thinking, that's the guy now. He don't pay taxes anymore. Maybe that's why he asked about who the boy belonged to. I don't know. I mean, I can't be dogmatic on it. But I can tell you this. I can tell you that David's daddy's steps, they were ordered by the Lord. And I think that even the thought that Jesse had when he thought about those three older boys, when he said, I wonder how my boys are doing. I believe even that thought was something that God placed in his mind, and he calls David and says, hey, go check on your brothers. And it set everything in motion. God directs us. Don't ever let that escape you, folks. I've got to the point in my life when if I have something that hinders me from jumping in my vehicle, if I'm hindered by 2 minutes, all I'm thinking is, God, are you protecting me from a wreck? I mean, I've got to the point where I think that way. You know, it's like, well, why did that phone call come in at that particular time? Was God keeping me from having something horrific happen? Because if I'd have been a few seconds earlier, I may have been involved in something bad. And so it's taught me something. It's taught me to just kind of have a little more contentment in my life. Don't get all anxious because God may be directing my steps in a way that I don't even understand. And God's doing the same thing with you, folks. If you want to walk with God, God will direct your steps. He will help you prepare. He'll help you plan. And I'm telling you, he will give you things in your soul and it's like, man, that's just good. That's just good. Well, next week, one of the most misunderstood chapters in our culture today, when I shouldn't say misunderstood, one of the most lied about chapters in the whole Bible is 1 Samuel chapter 18. It says that David and Jonathan's souls were knit together. Next week, I'm going to tell you how that in this country today that there's blasphemy being taught about that passage of Scripture. Let's stand together. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I hope that you've enjoyed it. Oh, there's a lot in this old book, folks. A lot in this old book. Well, the musicians are coming to the instruments.